This is UN News. I'm Conor Lennon. Now, on May the 16th, the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs released their latest World Economic Situations and Prospects report. Basically, it's a look ahead, predicting what the global economy is likely to do in the coming months. As ever, it's a mixed bag, depending on what part of the world you're in. But there's no denying that the momentous consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic continue to haunt us all in various ways. The report explains how we're still suffering from a COVID hangover. It also has interesting things to say about the potential consequences of the energy transition. In other words, weaning the world off its dependence on fossil fuels and moving to clean, renewable technologies. Hamid Rashid is an economist at the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs and the lead author of the report. Hello, Hamid. Thanks for coming to the studio today.
Thank you.
So I did read through the report and lots of interesting things to say, which we'll come to in just a moment. But first of all, I'm interested, how, when these reports come out, how do they affect global markets and how are they used?
So we don't really track the effect on global markets. Market relies on their own sources of data, but our main audience are the member states. And we believe that the member states pay attention to our numbers and some of the numbers that we produce vis-a-vis the numbers that come out of the Washington, D.C.-based organizations are different.
So you know, the IMF,
and the World Bank. On average, our number have been actually in a verified by independent parties that we actually are on the ball, and most of the times our numbers are actually right on the dot. So in many ways, numbers matter, and we don't go in different directions. Our directions are usually the same coming out of the IMF and the World Bank. But overall, with the member states pay attention to our numbers, academia they pay attention, markets. We don't know. Probably it's one of the data points that they look into, but not it's not the, it's not going to move the Wall Street, the NASDAQ.
Right. You're seeing massive swings the day after the report is released.
No, it's not going to happen that, no.
Yeah. And what kind of feedback do you get? You say that this is for member states primarily. Do you have a lot of dialogue with member states?
So, yes, often it's through a very informal means. Like sometimes we'd get a call, would want to understand what the numbers are, what do they mean, and just to give a sense about it's not just about the next few months. Actually, we provide 2-year forecasts. So this is for the current year and the next year. So we are into the fifth month of the current year. So we have a forecast for the whole year and we have the forecast for next year. And this is of interest to many member states because if they're looking at some of their budgetary issues or other macroeconomic issues, often we get emails from the capitals asking us for some clarification. So we provide that.
Yeah. Right, so it's a very useful service for a lot of countries.
We believe so, yeah.
Now, let's dig into it a little bit. Inflation. I want to start with inflation because I know that this has been a huge worry in recent months in various countries. I mean, my background is I'm from, brought up in the UK, and I know that the inflation problems there have caused a lot of people real problems. This is a very developed economy. So I know that inflation has been causing problems in many countries. Yeah. But your report says that you think that this situation is improving. You're not as worried as you have been. Yeah. Why is that?
I think inflation has come down significantly. The peak that we had in 2022, and since then, in all developed economies, they've fallen significantly in the European Union, in the UK, and the US, and from high single digit to in some countries even double digit. So we are seeing now at low single digit numbers. They're not up to the point where central banks can say, we have achieved our fight against inflation, we have won the war. There's still some sort of a little bit of to come down, especially for the Federal Reserve. We mentioned that in the press conference today that Federal Reserve targets a specific variable, which is called PCE, inflation, personal consumption expenditure inflation. That inflation is not about what you buy, but what you consume. Right. And that inflation seems to be stickier than what you buy, because one of the components of that inflation is your rent and housing expenses. Imputed rent. If you are living in your own house, which you own, Federal Reserve would still calculate how much you'd have paid if you had to rent this and how much it have gone up. And those numbers are pretty slow moving numbers. And that really make it difficult for the number to come down very quickly. And there are a lot of literature research suggesting that maybe this 2% inflation target probably is not really necessary at this stage. And we wrote about it as well. But we are overall quite satisfied that the trajectory of inflation right now across countries, of course, there are some countries still a very high inflation in developing countries, but overall, the trend is very positive.
And the reason we care about this is because it means the prices of things that you buy are not going to be going up, and there's very often a lag between the cost of things and how much your wages go up.
Yeah, exactly. So you got it right in terms of, so ultimately it boils down to their people's ability and their standard of living, right? And if your prices are going up higher than your wage growth rates, you are basically worse off in real terms. You have less money in your pocket. So even if your salary hasn't gone down, so you feel poorer. And that is the effect that you see in across countries, that when inflation is very high, people feel very nervous because they are not able to spend as much. And that becomes also a self-fulfilling prophecy sometimes. When they spend less, economy starts slowing down. And that's the challenge, also a challenge.
It's that vicious circle you want to avoid.
Yeah.
Some other flash points. Well, we have the Ukraine war going on for a while now, and then we now have this catastrophic war in Gaza. Mm. What effects are they having on the global economy right now?
So the war in Ukraine, when it started, of course, we saw a huge spike in commodity prices. Oil prices shot up, grain prices shot up, but they have normalized over the last 2 years.
Is that because people are getting grain from different places now?
Yes. Market adjusts very quickly. Market is often efficient, so we don't see a huge spike. And then we have the Gaza war that started last October, and you see that again, some increases in oil price and some commodity prices, but then stabilized. So global market is in a way responding to this crisis more efficiently. There are alternative sources are emerging. So we didn't see that kind of severe effect on prices from the Gaza war. But we're seeing other effects on freight prices have gone up that will show up subsequently, because Red Sea is a very important trade route for many of the shipment coming from Asia to Europe and North America.
And the ships just can't go through that, that area.
Yes, facing challenges that has, when you're going through Cape of Good Hope in Africa, you're adding about another 15 days of travel time. So it really adds up a lot of cost. So that's definitely a factor. And overall geopolitical risks are not, this is one of the headwinds that we discuss in the report, that the biggest headwind right now is geopolitical risk for the countries and for the regions. And that's why we have adjusted downward the growth forecast for West Asia and also some of the countries in Africa. Actually, a majority of the countries in Africa also, we have downward revisions for those countries.
I mentioned the COVID hangover, and we're not over it yet, are we? And it's very interesting to look at your longer term graph at that period when COVID hit, and it looks like the global economy almost comes to a standstill. But then there's quite a sharp rebound after that. Now, where are we now on that scale? Are we kind of back to where we would have been if there hadn't been a pandemic, or is it still going to be several years before we get back to where we would have been?
So there's an illusion there in terms of a huge spike in 2021. We call it base effect. So you depress it too much, and then the growth, you have negative 10% growth or negative 5% growth. And the next year, even if you have 3% growth, it looks amazing. So you're absolutely right in terms of, we have not actually gone back to the pre-COVID trajectory of global growth. Still, there are a lot of headwinds to global growth, especially on the trade side. Last year was one of the weakest trade momentum that we observed in any peacetime in any year. 2023 was a very slow year. And trade is a major driver of economic growth, especially for developing countries that are very dependent on exporting their commodities or manufactured goods. So trade is yet to go back to the normal trajectory. And also in many countries, especially in Africa, public spending matters a lot. How much government can spend, and they're being squeezed by high levels of debt. So there's not enough fiscal space for governments to support. Unlike in developed economies, you can always have, either borrow from the capital market and spend as much as government needs to spend. But in developing countries, this is not the case, especially in Africa.
Right. So they didn't get that. They didn't have that cash fund to lean on when things were already bad. And
exactly.
Now the people of those countries are paying the price. Yeah. And basically, it's austerity, isn't it? Cutting back on public spending and all those basic services.
Yes, and we have been always very critical, consistently critical of austerity measures, especially when there's an economy is on a recovery path, because then you slow down the recovery. Because, you know, we have evidence from both developed economies and developing economies that austerity actually hurts growth. And we saw it in Greece, we saw it in Argentina, we saw it many other countries. So, and we wrote about this in our previous reports, that fiscal austerity can be very costly. While they need to have fiscal balance and over medium term, but sometimes government has to spend to keep the economic momentum, because sometimes public spending crowds in private investments. If you're building a new road, then you start a factory. If you don't have a road, you can't start a factory. So public investment is often a critical catalyst for private investment and economic activities.
Now, this is the thing that I thought was really interesting, this whole area of critical minerals. And this is all to do with the transition and all the unintended and maybe intended consequences of this idea of doing what we know we want to do, which is to stop burning fossil fuels, fossil fuels, they drive the climate crisis, and move towards this clean energy system where we're not burning carbon. And what that means is moving to renewable sources, electric transport. But one of the consequences is this critical minerals, this massive ramping up of the number of rare earth minerals that are needed to, for example, power an electric car. There's a great graph in your report, which struck me, was just the amount of these minerals that are needed in one electric car compared to how many are needed in a conventional car, which is tiny in comparison. Yeah. So let's talk a bit about this whole area of critical minerals. I mean, you say that this could be a new version of the so-called resource curse. Now, that's what we mean by that is when we talk about countries that have these minerals, the raw minerals that power the earth. So traditionally, it's been coal, oil. Yeah. The people in those countries that have those materials don't necessarily benefit. It's all basically being used to power the developed economies, the rich countries. Yeah. And you say that this could be one of the consequences of this energy transition. Yeah. All the countries that have these minerals, those people will not benefit.
Yeah. So this consequence is not inevitable, and this is what we are suggesting, actually, how to avoid that consequence. So if you read it, you know, at the report, we're basically making a case here that if countries can have the right policies in place, and many countries are actually putting the right policies in place to avoid the resource curse, because they're learning from past mistakes.
So what kind of things can they do then?
So there are, for example, you can have comprehensive industrial and innovation policies. For example, in the previous commodity cycles, many of the countries in Africa or Latin America, their goal was to get as much minerals out of the earth and export it as raw ores and minerals. But this model is not very sustainable, because, you know, you don't get much value. A ton of copper ore doesn't give you a lot of money. But if you can turn into copper wares and copper other materials, you can have a lot more value addition. And that's what countries are trying to do with innovation policies, industrial policies. It's a sort of a large set of policies coming together. For example, you need to have the right fiscal framework to make sure you have the right incentives. Often, it's very difficult for countries in Africa or Latin America to have manufacturing, right? You know, you have to bring the technology, you have to bring the right investment, but countries are paying attention to this round. So we are more optimistic that this can be avoided with the right kind of strategic decisions that governments can make.
So would that mean, for example, rather than just digging the mineral out of the ground, you're actually creating the components for example, an electric car in that. And is that happening? Are you seeing that in developing economies?
Some countries are looking into at least first stage of value addition. For example, even if you go to the component, in between the component and the raw, the ore that you get from earth, there's many steps in between. Take the case of lithium. Lithium you find in either in a rock form, a spodumene, or in a salt flat in like Chile and some Argentine place. And you need a lot of purification. And most of the times, countries will do, they break down the rock and make it a concentrate of about 7% of lithium content. And that will be exported to China for China to process it further. Because you need lithium a purity level of 99.9%. But that from, say, 7% to bringing down to that, you know, that level of purity, there's a lot of processing involved. And some countries are now saying, look, we can do it better. And Chile is trying to do, you know, we do part of the processing there. African countries are not there yet in case of lithium, but they're trying to look at different options to have more value addition locally. Before you go to the component, this is like downstream. Now, you have the upstream mines, you have the midstream processing, and downstream, basically, components that OEMs, you know, that it goes into the cars, and that's, you know, way down the road. Yeah.
And you mentioned that there are fears of a persistent demand supply gap.
Yeah.
So, meaning that the supply of critical minerals, as you say, will lag despite this projected growth in potential demand. Now, does that mean that, this energy transition that we want to see, this could be slowed down because we don't have enough minerals?
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of a, some ways it's sort of self-defeating because everyone is trying to bring, there's a lot of demand, anticipated demand that you want to have a lot more if you want to achieve net zero. Lithium production has to go up by 2.5-fold, lithium carbonate production by 2030. This we have just 6 years left, right? 2.5 times. But technology is becoming also a hindrance because a lot of people are not willing to invest a lot of money into lithium processing if the technology shifts to something else. For example, there are, you know, talking about sodium ion batteries. Other technologies have also been considered. So that is why it's a paradox, because normally when there's a supply-demand gap, you'd find prices to skyrocket. But in critical minerals, you're seeing the opposite trend right now. Prices are actually going in the opposite direction, especially for lithium, which is concerning. That means a lot of investments that need to come right now are not coming in because they're looking at the prices. They say, look, you know, wait a minute, this price is not in the right, not giving the right signal. So we believe this is where the global cooperation is to be stronger. We need to target, we need to be serious about achieving our net zero target, and there's no other technology available right now. To put it bluntly, the point that you made, that you know, the amount of critical minerals that we need in a EV car, we need to get dirty before we can get clean. So that's the window that we have, and we have to get it right. And we don't have a lot of time right now. And you're absolutely right. If we don't change the trajectory right now, we'll not be able to achieve the net zero target because there's no other viable technology available other than lithium ion batteries right now. It may come in 10 years' time, but it'll be too late.
But not now.
Yeah.
Well, if you're interested in this area, and many people, I recommend you take a look at the report, which, Hamid, you have with you, the World Economic Situation and Prospect 2024 report, the mid...
Mid-year update. Yeah.
Where you can just Google that and you can find it. It's very easy to find. And I'm not an economist. I understood it. So the very clear language, and it's a very interesting read. Hamid, thank you very much. And we hope to see you for the next one.
Thank you, Connor. Have a good day.